Hey, welcome to another episode of Oliver Voiceover with Kip VH. I'm your host, Kip VH. With me at his studio, I am just thrilled to be sitting here with Mark Estale. Mark.
Estelle, even.
Estelle.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm English, so it's... and Kif van der Hoover?
Yeah, close. Yeah. I'm Dutch, so it's fine.
Good, okay, yeah.
We met... it was right after I did a session for Horizon Zero Dawn. I want to say 2 years ago.
It is 2 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, and you showed me... the miking system that you did you develop that system or
Basically it was about it's the mic attached to the head.
Yeah, it's like what I would expect to see like at a rock concert with like Lady Gaga or Madonna wearing one of those things.
There's
right?
two different ways of doing it, and when I developed it, it was my whole approach to the studio was about liberating the performer. And a standard mic is like a cage.
Yeah.
And an actor who's got a really physical character wants to move.
Yes.
And as soon as they get into the character, they're moving off mic. And so they got a retake. And I thought, well, it makes sense to attach the mic to them.
Yeah.
And so I started doing that in, 2005? And then I did a talk in London, in Brighton, at the Develop Conference about it. Phil Kovats, who was the audio director at Naughty Dog.
Okay, yeah.
Came to the talk and went, great idea. So they adapted it.
Really?
For Naughty Dog. And so the sound stage, the motion capture stage at Sony here.
Yeah.
The new motion capture stage, which is phenomenal.
Oh, man. Is that where they did God of War?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so the way they do all their ADR in post is using the DPA microphones. So they're actually attaching them to their head as part of the motion capture rig, but then they're using it as a skull cap with the mic attached when they're doing the ADR sessions in the studio. So wherever they're doing any of the Naughty Dog recording or the Sony recordings, it's based on what I was doing in London. I didn't know. And it was only when I was invited to go to the special BAFTA award for Amy Hennig.
Oh, really?
I went there, and I hadn't seen Phil for, nearly 10 years?
Uh-huh.
And he came over and he gave me his hug and said, you changed the way we recorded. And I went, what? And I just say, well, what I do is go, these guys are really fucking phenomenal what they do with voice and performance and games, you know.
Yeah.
And it was just like, and I didn't realise that it was technically tied into, you know, what I was talking about, 13 years ago.
That's so fascinating.
Yeah.
How that completely transforms and the experience of recording.
Yeah.
And, let me back up. How did you get started in all of this?
Well, in voice for games, I'm a mad gamer.
Okay.
But I started life as an actor.
Really?
As a kid, I was doing street theatre and I had my own little company. We go around and just do... It was like real guerrilla shit.
Uh-huh.
You know, we just do these sketches and bring a town centre to... You know, I just did it because I loved it. You know, just watching people get angry the most fun is actually when somebody's walking down the street and there's a miserable day and they've got loads of shopping and they stop and see something silly. And just seeing that transformation from their trudging to a little lightness in their step
was just addicted
to the audience, really.
Yeah.
And we just write bonkers sketches and then... A real sort of classic, you know, not rags to riches, but it was a theatre director saw us doing the stuff, and he said, I'm doing a national tour, would you like to join my company?
Really?
On the national tour. And so I went on tour for 3 months with his company, got paid nothing.
Uh-huh.
But doing the tour, we were doing major theatres and stuff, and it was... I fell in love with the tech side and the lighting and the sound and you know, when I wasn't on stage, I was with all the designers and the techies and the audio people and you know, I completely fell in love with being behind the scenes because how you transform a performance with tech is just magical.
I agree.
So and I you know, and I just completely fell in love with all that. And the tour finished, and I thought, I'm going to take this seriously, and I wanted to get a drama school. So I applied to go to Manchester Poly, which was quite well known then. But the intake was in September, and the tour finished at Christmas. Huh. Then I met a roadie in a pub. It was a friend of mine who was actually roading for a band called Hawkwind. Uh-huh. And he was like the drum roadie. He said, fucking great. You know, he was telling me all these stories on the road. And I thought, I've learned enough tech to actually do that job. So I picked up the phone book to find the nearest gigging superstar near my house. And I found this guy who ran a band called Magna Carta, who had a hit in about 1961, but they just tore endlessly. And I rang him up and said, I'm a sort of theatre guy into the tech, and I want to blag a gig. And he just laughed at me. But we started talking, and he said, yeah, you sound really interesting, come around and see me. And the long story is, I went around to see him, and I just rebuilt this old motorbike. I'm a big biker.
Okay.
And I'd found this old 1958 Triumph Tiger in a junkyard. Uh-huh. Basically, used to play football next to this junkyard. I kicked the ball over one day, went to fetch the ball, and in the corner of this thing was this rotting motorbike.
Oh man!
And I persuaded the guy who owned the junkyard to sell it to me. I bought it for £20 or something, and I'd completely built it and restored it. And I turned up on this place, and Chris, the band, who just looked at it and went, oh, this is awesome. And then we just got chatting, you know. Yeah. It was like, and he said, I don't really have a job, I'm not going to pay you, but you can come along, you know, we can get you onto the rider and onto the into the hotels and stuff, and it'd be good to have you along.
Great.
2 weeks into the tour, the sound guy got offered an amazing job with a huge Australian band and went, I'm going, bye.
Yeah.
And then Chris said to me, before we hire somebody back from England, would you like to have a go? I went, okay. I got behind the mixer, and it was like coming home. And it was just like, and it's just the hair went on the back of my neck. I went, oh, fucking hell, this is awesome. And they liked what I did. And then I started doing that. Then it just went on to other things. And 10 years later, I'd been toured endlessly, then I went into recording studios, into record production, all that kind of stuff. And had an absolute blast, really. But it was just like, the music industry is kind of dull. You start, you know, you tour, the first 2 weeks of touring are a novelty, you know.
Yeah.
It's that partying, hard work, great thing, gigs, audiences. And then it's just the same again for, you know, forever.
Yeah, with different wallpaper.
Yeah, but it's you know, it was great fun, it was energising, and I'm a real problem solver, I build stuff. And so I became kind of known as a troubleshooter. So when stuff went down somewhere, I get flown into fix it and pull it together, you know. Yeah. So I'll be out and, you know, pop festival, the PA goes down, nobody knows how to fix it, you know, it's like, call Mark, you know. So it's like, it was a really nice, you know, I had a really nice time, but then I wanted to marry and settle down. Yeah. And I kind of gave it up. But then somebody rang me up about doing this for video games. I was going, you know, it was about to run a voice studio for video games. This was like 93.
So were you a gamer at this point already?
Yeah, I was. You know, I was totally into all the early LucasArts stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. Oh, boy.
Day of the Tentacle.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, all that stuff. It was great. All the point-and-click adventures. Yeah. I'm a massive adventure fan. And the thing is, the writing with them was really good.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh, God, this is theatre, this is tech, this is everything I love.
Huh.
Yes, I'll do it. So I, you know, gave up what I was doing to help run the studio, set up and run the studio, and I did it. Then I did it for another company, setting up two studios for them. And but they were kind of corporate organizations. One of them was they're both actually localization companies, because localization translation for games.
I see.
So at the time, really, most developers, if they were having voice content, they were just recording it themselves. You know, who needs actors because they can speak? You know, that kind of mentality.
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you some stories, but not on mine. What happened, I'd gone into these companies, set up the studios, and then plugged into the sort of European dubbing network for all the movie dubbing and stuff like that, getting them in for games. And we set up something called Media for Europe in about 96. But then at the same time, it was, I had my daughter who was a year old. And I was away all the time. I thought, what the fuck am I doing?
Yeah.
You know, working for somebody else. And I was starting to have production ideas and design ideas and stuff. And when you're in an organization, it's just like, you've got to deal with other people. I thought, nah, my wife wanted to go back to study. And she got offered a sort of postdoctorate teaching post.
Oh, great.
To do more, you know, genetics and stuff. So
genetics, that's her study?
And where she did genetic pure science, she's now global head of science from biomedical. It's his next wife as well now, I'm happily remarried. But
me too.
My eldest daughter was less than one, and I'd hardly seen her. And I just, what the fuck am I doing?
Yeah.
So I just thought, I said to my wife, so we talked about it, and we decided to switch over and I look after the kid.
Yeah.
And she'd go to university, and we moved out into the country. And to keep myself sane, I built a little studio on the side of the house. And then EA rang up, and, you know, they had these couple of projects, and we ended up, you know, doing a couple of them. Even when the studio was unbuilt, you know, with duvets hung in the garage and all that kind of...
Right. Oh, yeah!
And then, you know, then we got a couple of other projects, and I set up OM in September of 96. But then it was, you know, I just, because I tinker.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing about it is, you know, so, and I ask why all the time, why do you do that? You know, it's like the motorbikes. You just go, why is this here? What's that doing? Oh, I can take that bit off.
Yeah.
I can change that, you know. And it was exactly the same with the tech and the studios and stuff. And ever since I started, I'd kind of got I'd get in touch with the developers of the software for the studio.
Yeah.
And just saying, how about this? And how about that? And changing this and that. It all came out of that kind of messing around with the process.
Yeah.
But then you just, you know, you want to go, a recording studio is designed for recording sound. It's designed the way it is for linear production. It's designed around the engineering space. Like this studio, this is not a mix space.
Right.
This is, it's all about the relationship between the actor and the director.
Yeah.
And it's actually based on a model of production which is based on working with a spy in working undercover. Right. So you think it, okay, think
all right, talk me through this part.
I'll talk you through this one.
So, I mean, like, just to describe, like, the room is, they're, like, generally in a studio, I'll see a big old mixing board and then a window facing into here. But here you have a couple monitors and a regular sort of desk with a gigantic window giving you access to see even more.
Yeah, it's nice. But the one thing I wanted about so imagine this is Mission Impossible.
Okay.
And now you're sitting in the vehicle outside the embassy.
Yes.
Where Ethan is going in to do his job. Right. So this is like the command vehicle.
Like the van.
It is the van. So you've got the controller or the handler in control.
Yeah.
Yeah. The actor is the agent.
Yes.
And going into the game world. You know, so fundamentally, I basically looked at the parallel. I started doing this in about 2005, and it was basically, I'd seen an actor on stage, I've seen him on film. He was perfect for one of the roles I was casting for The Witcher when it first came round.
Yeah.
And I rang his agent and said, I'd really like him to come down and test for this because I didn't, you know, I'd never met him and stuff. And he came down, it was absolutely shit. And it was just like, it's Nathaniel Parker. Bless his cotton socks. He knows the story very well. But we sat down, and the more he tried, the worse he got.
Huh.
Because I was throwing him the script and he was, and he just couldn't pull it out of the script. And we went, this is shit. And he went, yeah, this is shit. I said, fancy a whiskey? And he said, fuck yeah. So we went upstairs in the studio, and I had some, you know, I have a collection of whiskey up there. Uh-huh. We sat down, and I wanted to deconstruct why he'd failed, because I knew he was a really good actor. And he's a phenomenal, you know, a phenomenal stage and film actor. And basically, his process is Stanislavski and script out performance.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's all about control, knowing every nuance of every meaning of every word, right? And it was like, yeah, it makes sense because, you know, when I'm dealing with a script of nearly a million words of dialogue and it's a complete non-linear mess, right, you know, to give him the script was just nonsense. It's meaningless to him.
Yeah.
And it was just like, but he needed to work in a way that, you know, I'd wanted his ability to have. Anyhow, the long and short of it is, we parted company, we got on really well.
Uh-huh.
Then his agent rang me up, and I thought, oh no, maybe it's just to tear me another arsehole, because I actually went, yeah, that's shit, and he went, yeah, that's shit. But then, you know, I don't know how sensitive
right,
he was being about it.
Are they going to blow up in your face?
And you know, and she said, no, he'd like to come back in. And he came back in and fucking nailed it. And I threw him other stuff, and he nailed it. And I went, whiskey again? And he got the job, he got the gig, and we've worked together ever since. But he came, we had a whiskey, and he said, I remember something from drama school. And it was that during that first year, they call it hot seating over there. What do they call it over here?
I've heard hot seat too.
But what's the other term? There's another term they use in the US. I heard somebody else use it. I thought, oh, that's interesting. It's fundamentally where you get interrogated as a character and you've got to stay true to the character.
Yeah.
And he was just talking to me about the process he'd gone through in the hot seating, where you go from that utter terror the first time you do it. Yeah. Am I going to be true to myself? You know, trying to think ahead. And there's the point when you relax, you can't think anymore, and the character comes out of you. So anybody throws anything at you, you're in the zone. And as soon as he said that, it was like all the lights came on. I went, fucking hell, because this is exactly what good voice actors do. You know, when you throw them a script, it's cold, and they just, it's there. They make a decision and they're free. Yes. And if they've got that flexibility, they've got that playfulness, they've got that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And at the same time this happened, I saw a documentary about the intelligence services and how they train and how, you know, an agent or whatever you call them,
yeah,
you know, the agent, spies, whatever, officers, operatives.
Operatives, I think.
But if you're actually working for an agency, you build, you know, a number of legends or a number of characters that you can switch into.
Huh.
But they do that for, you know, over a number of years. And sometimes you'll be living as another character for, you know, fundamentally hot seating in non-hostile environments, but for months on end. And it was just that
fascinating.
Yeah, and I just went, all fascinating. So I hung on to this. Then RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, a guy called Lloyd Trott, who's the dramaturge there, rang me up and said, look, we know games are significant media. Would you like to start doing these professional development workshops with the final year students? And I went, yeah, great, because here we are, total classically trained actors for fundamentally theatre.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they're a diverse school now. You know, that how to bring a classically trained actor from that whole thing about control, script out, learning, then performance, then repetition.
Yeah.
Authentic performance. To how do you bring somebody from that worldview into, you know, into this game chaos where there is no prep.
None.
You're throwing somebody straight into a world. And the, you know, they went, oh, the spy thing is the perfect analogy. Spies are actors. Somebody who's working under undercover is a better actor than most actors.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, I've had the pleasure since I started all this of having somebody from MI6 come, an agent, actually show me into their world somewhat, and came down to the studio and went, oh, fuck yeah. And it was like, because it's his skill set.
Yeah.
For play. You know, yeah. And it was just like, you know, once you get that perspective and you see the parallels and the connections, and it was just like the greatest actors I've ever worked with who would work in this field are, you put them together with the spine, they're the same beast. You know, they've got the same intelligence, they've got the same ability to play and respond and just be in the moment. Yeah. Because, and it's all about instinct. So that was the key. Then I thought I'd take this to the, you know, I'd been doing the stuff at RADA and doing this research for some number of years. And then I thought, no, and I bit the bullet. I thought, I'm going to be quite radical and bring this straight into the drama school. And I'd got all the students there and I was ready to the thing. Then Lloyd knocked on the door, who is this quite tour de force and quite a, you know, a real authority, very well respected in the industry, came and said, I'd like to sit in the session. Well, yeah, why not? You know, yeah. Because he will give me very, very straight and frank feedback. And I just basically introduced the whole spycraft analogy. And with the actors, it's like throwing a switch. Because they have that skill set, because it's core to the training of being an actor.
Yeah.
However, in all the media they work in, that is never, ever called upon. So if you're in theatre or in film or TV, what it is there is it's about rehearsal. Yeah, and yes, there may be some level of, you know, ad lib or improv within that, but it is very structured because you're actually building it towards a precise performance. You're blocking, right. You're doing the set, you're doing the, you know, the costume, the lighting and everything. So you're part of a creative process that has a performance as the end result.
Yeah.
So you're locked into, you know, the investment is in rehearsal towards performing something that's, it's, you know, on the nail.
Yeah. Where it was fascinating, that idea too, about how someone who focuses on this 3-month process to get to a final product versus finding and feeling the immediacy in that moment when you get a script.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's that, but that's how we live life. You know, all we're doing is emulating life.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's all about instinct. It's about feeling the moment. And so, you know, that rehearsal process is just emulating life, you know, and the performance is, a good performance is as if it's, you know, truthful to that moment for that character.
Yeah.
But all you're doing, you know, you're not acting instinctively. You know, the skill is giving the impression of instinct, isn't it? Because you know what's going to come down the line.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas in life, you don't. But the great thing is, you know, the other thing was with my kids, I got, you know, I've now got 4 kids and it's, and I love reading to them. And you get a book and you read it to them the first time. And it's nuanced, it's beautiful, and it's lovely.
Yeah.
And it's like one of the things I noticed with actors coming and reading a script, especially advertising copy. It was a really interesting one. I've done a few, and it's not my industry at all, but it was just like somebody comes in, picks up the script, they've never seen it before, and reads it. Fucking glorious. And then they spent 6 hours deconstructing it by word and syllable and emphasise the... And not the butter, what I mean?
Yeah.
And they just discount in it, and then they spend 6 hours. You got a committee of producers and people fearful for their jobs, going, oh, I'm not sure. Then they go back to the original read, which was cold with no direction at all. Because guess what? It was instinctive and came from a human being. And that is who we are and who we're communicating to. Yeah. So, and it was just like putting that together. And the whole thing about a spy being, they have to be in environments, they haven't a clue what's going on.
Yeah.
And they cannot think because, you know, in the moment, they can't think about responding. They've got to respond wholly as that character they're playing. Because if there's a slight pause, Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, because generally, if you're in a hostile environment, everybody's looking out for the infiltrator, especially if you're doing something illegal. You're looking for the police. You're looking for the people who are working undercover. So their performances, and they have to wholly believe who they are and be utterly in the moment. The skill set is normal acting on steroids, and they're fucking glorious. They are bloody amazing. And they've got other skills as well, which are just like, oh, that's nutty. But, you know, I'm probably not allowed to talk too much about those. But it was... But it was that thing, and I was thinking, okay, so how do I facilitate that? This is a very long-winded thing, but how do I facilitate that in the production? So I just completely deconstructed the recording studio and went, okay, this is the objective. Somebody wholly instinctive in the moment, free, comfortable, you know, being able to live in the moment. And it was just like, oh, yeah, one of the things is removing the microphone, which is the cage. Yeah. So the microphone's attached to them. And then if you take in the analogy of a spy in the world, the best way of I worked out or thought about was actually, for the actor, the best way to be is actually in the game. Yeah, because I've sat in on sessions where a director's got a script. He doesn't know what's happening in game. Right. He's just saying, "Well, can you just give me this line three ways?" You know, "Oh no, yeah, move on to the next one. One of those will stick." You know, you go, "No, that's not acting. That's just making something stick and making do by numbers." That's why so many bloody voice in games is pretty shit, actually. But it's actually once you see where you are and know where you are, and you can hear the ambience and stuff, you're in the moment.
Absolutely.
And as soon as, so where the spy goes into the world, I wanted to take the actor and drop them into the game world. I don't want to be talking to them as a director. Hmm. You know, I want them to be living in the moment.
Yeah.
And what I am, so it's a very collaborative way. So we don't have any talkback button or that in the studio because we're talking together. So it's again, it's the spy analogy. They've got their team in their earpiece supporting them, enabling them to achieve their objective. Exactly the same here.
Exactly the same.
So you've got, you know, us that are my team. You know, the tech is invisible. The tech guy, you know, the engineer is in no way is completely. It's like a sound recordist on a film set. You don't see him.
Yeah.
You know, they set the tech up, then they vanish.
Right.
Yeah. Action. You know. You know. You see that little boom mic come in, it goes straight on YouTube. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
But it's the same. It's the same thing. So the engineer in the studio is out of the way. The tech center. It's all about the performance. It's all about being in the moment, and you know, liberating the actor to just enter the world and just be the character. So yeah, the mic set up. So you've got a multiple screen set up as well, where you've got the visuals, and so you can have any visual from the game in front of you.
And concept art and like or whatever.
Anything that informs the moment.
Yeah.
So we use the sound design, but sometimes and the music. You know, so we've got all those things available, and the more you have, the better.
Oh,
and it's all it. And you don't have to use it all, but it's just giving the actor what helps them just stay alive and in that moment and correct to the space.
Yeah.
Because it's all about connection. You know, it's all about momentum and connecting to the environment you're in.
Yeah.
The thing that breaks performance is disconnect. You know, there's the fundamental disconnect of an actor not being having the ability to connect to a character. But I put that aside. It's all about space and time and where you are and the noise and the environment, the distances involved and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Because if you don't get those right, it's disconnected.
Yeah.
So you may, you know, I've been in sessions, I've watched sessions where you've got a director, and the actor. The actor's brilliant and the direction's sound.
Uh-huh.
But it's contextually wrong. You get it in game, and you go, "Oh, that's too much. Oh, that's too little." You know what I mean? And there's that bed of pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in post-production.
Yeah.
But if you actually bring everything together at the point of production, you know exactly how it's going to be in game at the very creative point of it, and it's a fucking load of fun. You know. And I've been trying to bring the whole tech out to the States for some time and the whole methodology.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's, it's over 10 years now. And, you know, I said, well, we do this kind of revolutionary thing back in London. And everyone's just going, yeah, interesting, you know, we do it this way. And it's just like, well. And then the end last, you know, it was Horizon. I went, fuck it, I'm going to build a place out here and show, make that impact, show the difference.
It was unlike any other recording experience I've ever had.
Yeah.
And like both working with Jamie on that session and with not only the tech, but then our conversation afterwards, just completely transforming the notion of the traditional roles of director being in charge. This commitment to team and equality in it.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of been an actor, it's what you aspire to. Casting and stuff is building a team. It's just like any kind of recruitment. You want people you can work with and have fun with and do really good shit with.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Life's too short for, being a wage slave or, a puppet. And it's just like it's kind of really, when I'm working, I want the actors, I don't have a complete vision. And, I can consider an actor the master of character. Mm. And you're playing characters day in, day out. Yeah. You're thinking about characters. You're watching people. You're probably pretending to be different people out in the real world for the fun of it.
Every drive-through. Every drive-through, I'm from a different country or a different celebrity. It's very fun, especially in L.A., because people might think that you might be Bruce Willis and then be disappointed when you pull up and get your iced coffee.
Yeah, I used to do the same shit. But I still do, But it's fun. It's an immense amount of fun. But the level of expertise that an actor has is precious. And it is so finely focused, on character. So when an actor comes in, they're bringing a wealth of stuff that is beyond my vision, however creative I am.
Uh-huh.
What they're bringing is something utterly magical, and it can take it in different directions. So my thing is let that magic happen. Mm. We do it with developers now, is that we try to cast really early in the production.
Mm.
So the developer buys into the voice. When I'm casting, the people I'm really talking to is the writing team, the art team, the animation especially. Uh-huh. Because, it's like for a game, you don't know what the range of motion of a character is. So on certain games, it's very, characters are very static. So the performances have to meet the animation capability of the game.
Yeah.
So actually connecting with the animators is probably one of the very first things I want to do as a director, is to understand, what the capability is within the game engine. Because it's another disconnect.
Yeah.
If an actor is giving you a big performance, and the animation is quite static.
So if the,
it's disconnected, it's broken, it's wrong.
Yeah.
Likewise, if you've got a really animated performance, and
it's supposed to be
pretty flat, they're running down a hill, and the actor's going, well, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
completely. And it's all those disconnects, but it's actually, I want to talk to the animators, I want to see what they're doing, and then discuss how the dialogue's going to be delivered within that before we even start casting, but then drawing the actors into that so they can really connect with the actor. I mean, connect with the character.
Yeah.
And that's why we do all this experimental facial capture stuff as well, which you haven't seen. But, some of the technology we were working on got bought by Apple, which was a pain in the ass because they just buried it. That was with a company called FaceShift a couple of years ago, where we could do the real-time animation really simply.
Like the Snapchat filter where you can map a face of. I did a bunch of those a couple Thanksgivings ago. It was a bunch of celebrity impressions.
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah.
But they're so simple to do. But actually, if you can get the actor connected with the actual animated character, then they can see how that character's going to be working. If you can do it in real time, just work with them.
Just to get a sense of the weight of what you're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, in the motion capture volume and seeing some of the... I did mocap with Rockstar Games years ago, and all I ever saw was a wireframe. But recently seeing how I can completely adjust my performance, and it's such an easy fix with that connected to an engine that shows you what's going on immediately, that I can adjust the performance to match so we can tell the story effectively. Yeah.
So any animators out there, give me some 3D models. So because we've got, you know, we're pushing the boundaries of the sort of facial capture stuff right now, and we're getting the tech from everywhere and everywhere, you know, anywhere and everywhere to test it and try it, because I want that real time thing. The new head rigs we've got are from Standard Deviation, are super light, and they're just, you know, completely unobtrusive, and we're looking at different ways of working with it. Because again, you don't want the technology to get in the way of the performance, but you want the performance to be connected to the technology. You know,
What are you, when you're doing a casting?
Yeah.
What are you specifically? What's going to make you go, interesting, or this is garbage? And I know that you know, there's so much variety in the types of things that you're casting, but what are things that actors do that will either distinguish themselves in a positive way or distinguish themselves in a negative way that prohibit them from showing the wealth of what they can do by making stupid mistakes?
Well, I think, you know, what we normally do, especially out here, is we ask for self-submits first. And then we'll call people in. Mm. So we'll make a selection process on self-submits. And we generally put a casting brief out, you know, of all the characters we're looking for. Mm. And sometimes it's staged. You know, we focus on a couple of characters like we're just doing here. But then there's another 100 characters behind this coming up. You know, so we're looking at the ability. So it's really, the fundamental is natural acting is what I want, you know. And it's about, you know, one of the things you radars out to is how well the actor knows their strengths. And I think if they're approaching me for a casting, I just want to see their strengths. I don't want to see their hopeful attempts at doing something they're not quite there yet.
Yeah.
You know, 20-year-old doing a really old person. You know, there are going to be some old people who are going to be doing it. And I want people, old people, to do their olds, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, it's you know, accents and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a British director. Having American actors who kind of do a really bad British submit, it's going, that doesn't really inspire me to think that they have the intelligence, really, to work with me. They're going to be a spy going undercover in a hostile situation. They need to be on the nose.
Yeah.
You know, once they're in the door, then we can fuck around and try things out.
Sure.
Yeah? But getting in the door, you know, so if there's 15 characters, choose the one that you know you're good at. Because if you come in and get close on that, then that goes, interesting. But if you sent 15 submissions in and 14 of them are a bit mediocre, the one that was good, by the time we get to that one, you've wasted our time. Mm. You know, what the fuck? Sometimes I can play you some of the auditions we've had in recently, where somebody has done a submission for every single male character, you know, from, you know, and they're a mid-40s actor with a kind of husky voice, and they were doing from kids to really old people. Their old people were vaguely, but the younger, and it was just like, no. And there was different accents in there, you know, and it was just like, you know, and it was just, carpet bombing.
Yeah.
And it was just like, that doesn't show production awareness, because casting takes a lot of effort and time. So the team really want to hear good stuff. And, you know, so know what your good stuff is and submit that.
Yeah.
End. You know, if you can do beyond that, great. Show it to me when we're face to face and when we're in the pub having a scotch or a, you know, a bottle of sake or two.
That's really tremendous advice, and just simply because I think I know when I've had like choose three sort of auditions to like really you know, really pick my shots. I don't want to send you something that's a B minus.
Yeah, well, somebody,
for the sake of doing it.
Yeah, we have a scale. There's A to D. Huh. It's awesome to dreadful. Huh. And basically every actor, so if you submit for four roles, all those four roles will be scored from A to D. The average of those will give you a call score. Hmm. So if you submit one and get a B, you'd be called. But if you set four and two of them are C's and one's a D, you get a C, which is crappish, and it will go down the scale.
Yeah.
So, and it's just a numbers game. You know, we get thousands of submissions at the time.
Yeah.
And we say to the agents as well, I know, just I put a little description in a brief I sent out to the agents, that we actually score the agents on the strength of the actor's score. So if they send us a bunch of actors and there's loads of C's and D's in there, that reflects on the agent. So the agent gets a CD score.
Yeah.
It's simply because why are you submitting stuff that isn't really showing off your strengths? You know, my objective is I want to hear somebody's voice and go, fuck yeah, right. That's it. I want my clients to go, oh, yeah, you know, yeah. Everything.
Yeah.
You don't want to be wading through, oh, really, really? I know people are going to learn and train, but when you're actually coming into the production front end, it takes, you know, I have a team of people, the casting team, who are going through every single submission, making notes, doing everything, and they will do it on everything.
Yeah.
But if somebody's sending a load of stuff where they're just attempting to be something they're not, hey, some people are brilliant and nail everything, but it shows, you know, there'll be A's and B's all through the, you know.
Right, all through your matrix.
Yeah. On the matrix. It is the matrix.
It is the matrix.
But it is a very brute base. But it's, you know, it's you know, we're selecting an orchestra, you know.
Yeah.
And it's all those contrasts between the different characters and stuff. You know, and some people will submit a number of times and get really top scores and bring them in and they're brilliant, but they won't get the gig. And it's not because they didn't cut it. It's just because of the relationships between other actors.
Yeah.
Because you get somebody who will shape the production, and you want people to have textures and contrasts.
Yes.
You know, and sometimes you'll get three actors who are all brilliant, but they all sound roughly the same, and you can't have them playing off against each other because it'll just sound the same.
I cast a show at Second City, and I remember going through that audition process, telling everybody, look, I'm putting together an Avengers.
Yeah.
And I need a Hulk, and I need a Cap, and I need a, you know, Black Widow.
Yeah.
But I can't have two Captain Americas. It won't work.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah.
So the orchestra metaphor is much more, it's classier.
Yeah, but it's really conditioned, of course,
yes. But I totally hear what you're saying. And it's the kind of thing, too, that I think, you know, people judge their... I mean, all of us to a different extent, but people judge their worth based on their booking ratio, and that can't be the thing that you measure yourself by.
No, it, absolutely not. And I think the best advice I think I can give an actor coming into the for casting is make choices, make firm choices when you come in. Don't try and double guess. So if you've got a character brief, make choices about that character. You know, utterly commit to those choices and just go for it. You know, and then listen. Those are the two things. But the whole thing about making choices, you know, you talk about disconnect.
Yeah.
If somebody hasn't made a choice about who a character is, they're going to be disconnected. You know, if you don't have that backstory, if you don't have that inner feeling and utter connection with the character, then the character is floating off into a vacuum. It's uninteresting. It's boring.
Yeah.
You know, experienced actors come in for audition. They kind of go, this is a playground. It's to meet people, have some fun, throw some shit at, and something may stick.
Yeah.
You know, so they come in with this attitude of just like, I'm going to make some choices, have some fun, and I know I'm good, I'm going to get the job or not, it doesn't matter. But it's an experience that adds to your repertoire of experience, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Every casting session, it trains you, you learn stuff from it, you know. Sometimes it's the things you love, some things you go, no, I don't want to do this again, you know what I mean?
Right.
But it's that, you know, that they come in with... bring it on attitude. And they looked at the script, made choices, given the choices, then sat back and listened. And then, what I always do as a director when I get an actor in is I want the actor to make choices. Then if they're in the vacuum, it was just like, I'll try to pull them into space to make choices, try to get them to make choices. If they do, good. Mm-hmm. But then I'll get them to adjust and do something completely different.
Yeah.
So how about taking it in a different direction. Of course, so it's understanding whether you can, if somebody's got the intelligence to interpret a character and then to drop that interpretation and go in a different direction.
Yeah.
You know, and I will do that as part of a course because you're a team member with me.
Yeah.
And I want to know, let's do this, let's go this way together, let's go this way. And it's not a test in a sense of, tick or fail. It's just like, can we work together?
Right. Well, it's like putting on a jacket and doing this with your arms.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And like, what kind of give? I'm never going to be walking around like this, but at the same time, I want to know, do you move?
Yeah.
How do you listen? Are you fun to play with?
Yeah. But it's that thing is actually making very firm decisions about the character because if those decisions aren't made, you're dead in the water. Mm. And and oftentimes people come into a casting session and they're trying to please me. No, just please yourself to your ability. Don't try to please the director because you have no fucking clue what I want. When people are trying to double guess you or ask questions. I've had actors coming trying to re-ingratiate themselves with me. And it's just like, fuck off. I don't think about the actor at all in the booth when they're coming in for an audition. I've seen 700 people before them, and all I'm listening to is I've got the character in front of me and I'm listening to hear that character to come to life. That's all. Yeah, I don't want anything to interfere with that focus. Yeah. And when an actor comes in and touches on something, that character springs to life. Sometimes they'll bring stuff in and it'll spring to life in a completely different way than my imagination.
Uh-huh.
But it's as I don't want to be interfered with, because it's so intense when casting. And so if an actor comes in and just gives what they've got, then I'm going, that's interesting. You know what I mean? It's easy. They've got a momentum going. But when somebody comes in and they're watching me to see what my response is, I'm just scowling at a screen or my eyes shut sometimes listening, ignore the director, just give what you've got. Because generally, fundamentally every single actor has got something unique because they've got themselves. And from that, you can build anything, And it's just like, trust what you've got, That's what I,
That's great.
It's the truth of it, isn't it?
Yeah, it really, truly is.
Yeah.
You need to come in and tell your story and be you.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're a blue... Sorry, my wife says this all the time. It was her acting coach back in UMKC. It was like, you gotta put the pink in pink, man. Put the pink in it. If you're pink, don't diminish the pinkness of you. That doesn't help anybody.
I've never heard this one before. Shall we be pink right now?
But like, be the full vibrance, the full spectrum of the color that you are.
Yeah. Be you. That's me. I'm a curmudgeonly English guy. People say, this is America. People don't talk like over there. So I'm English. I talk in a certain way. I'm very, very straight. Very frank. Uh-huh. I talk about process and scales and matrices and how things are scored and laid up. People get terrified by it. But it's actually, it's just the process. It's the, it's a model. I can, just show you the models. I can show you the models for everything.
Yeah.
And it's, deep joy. Sorry about that. We're having another commercial break.
Now that I'm recording, I'm not saying anything.
Yeah, because it's just been the commercial break.
It's been the commercial break. Welcome back.
See, I can't do American.
You can't do American?
I can't do it. I'm out here. It's really weird. It's just, I can't do it. It's just an accent.
Some people have that. I don't even know what it sounds like. Some people have said that it's, I don't know. I mean, I'm a voice match guy, so I do impressions of, like, Vince Vaughn and Tom Hanks and those kind of guys.
Yeah.
But, whatever. It's fun.
Yeah. I kind of go for a kind of strange sour southern thing.
I like that southern sort of, like, I've never heard the southern accent sort of slurred like that, but I like
that. Yeah,
but
it kind of, that's the only kind of, yeah, but everyone just goes, what the fuck are you doing, mate? But see, so I'm a northerner in England, you know, so I'm Game of Thrones country, but my English, my northern is now Game of Thrones. All my kids live up there. Well, three of my kids live up there. And I was, when my daughter came out here, and I was going, right, you know, normal, that's all like this, back north, you know, like northern, you know. It's a friend of mine from Wakefield who talks like this all the time. And my daughter said, Dad, that ain't northern. Dad, you've forgotten, haven't you? You become southern, you know. It's like, I know, you know.
That's wild. Like, that's wild. There's so many different dialects all over.
Well, you're from California. It's kind of crazy town.
It's true.
Yeah, you know, I drove off the main road once over here. That's the freeway or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
You know, into this small town, and it was like, holy fuck, what is this accent? You know, and it was just like, you know, it was like my idea of kind of hillbilly.
Yeah.
And it was just like, whoa, but this is just mainland California. I just went to get some petrol, gas. You know,
it's like Central California rural. It's like this very kind of rural dialect.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
An old Nick there from New Orleans, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, listen, our time is winding down. What projects have you done that... you are really, not that you're not proud of all of your projects, but what projects do you wish got a little bit more attention that you would love people to revisit because there's some really dynamic, interesting stuff in there that you feel like, you know, got glossed over? Is there anything in your mind?
Everything. You know what I mean? It's just like, yeah, revisiting stuff is a tough, tough thing because you're always going, oh, yeah. You know, hindsight is a very precious thing. I don't look back. Hmm. You know, there's so many projects I love, but it's more to do with the people and the you know, the whole vibe of it and the challenge. You know, some of them are just really horrible, messy projects that are not great productions, but you're working with such an awesome bunch of people who are weaving magic out of turds. You know, it's kind of a brown-looking magic, but it's, you know, but, you know, the journey yeah. is, I think, is the most important thing. And, you know, and it's, the stuff I've loved, but it's always for weird personal reasons, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hired years ago to give Pac-Man a voice. And it was just like, no, Pac-Man's a little piece of cheese. It goes whacka, 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 you know.
Right.
And it was just like, but having the sort of committees and the bureaucracy behind, you know, behind that IP.
Yeah.
But it was an immense journey of bringing this character to life. And it was for a game called Pac-Man World 3.
Yeah.
And there were some really glorious moments in that script. So I look back to it now and just go, oh, that was awesome. And one of my favourites is the Time Splitters games.
Oh, yeah.
And Time Splitters Future Perfect. And you had an amazing animation team working on the cutscenes and the writing. There was some absolute, you know, I look back at the cutscenes now, and this was, you know, it was, what, 15 years ago?
Yeah.
And you look at some of those cutscenes in there and some of the scenes and the characterisation, the humour, and it's fantastic, beautifully animated, you know, and it, you know, nothing like the technology we have now, you know. So,
right, yeah. What do you see, or how are you bracing or preparing for like VR and those kind of things, or do you see that being? I mean, how do you feel that is going to impact? I mean, just from the Mission Impossible mentality, it seems even more immersive for the actors in that space.
Well, I think the issue in VR is depending, again, it's all about doing range of motion and how the design enables you to move within a space. You know, so for instance, you're having, you know, because in reality, you know, you can move freely in an environment in VR in a way that you, you know, you it still needs to be on rails to a certain degree.
Yeah.
So the VR voice stuff that works really well are the voices in your head, either inner voice or somebody on comms in your head, because that is a reference that is closer to all times.
Yeah.
Or in speakers in a room or something like that. But when you're having those really close, intimate conversations with somebody, and you can turn away from them and create those distances, you know, I call it Witcher 3 syndrome. In, you know, I don't know if you play Witcher 3.
Adore Witcher 3.
Yeah, so there's things about Witcher 3 which just drive me nuts, because you can get there's broken physics in the game. You know, for instance, how does Geralt get his swords out?
They just sort of...
They appear in his hands. They're in scabbards on his back.
Right.
His arms are not long enough to get them out of the... You know, that just, you know... And then it's chatting on a horse syndrome.
Uh-huh.
So you're chatting...
Racing.
And somebody races ahead of you, and you're still having that conversation. Okay, it's a suspension of disbelief for the player. They don't mind.
Right.
But the actual thing is, you psychologically take in things that are not real. Although you make allowances for them, you suspend, you know, disbelief.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, that conversation stays intimate, even though the person is racing ahead of you.
Right.
You know, because that conversation has started. Rather than going, oh, yeah, I was just saying, as you disappear over the horizon, you know.
Like, just from a programming standpoint, solve that problem.
Yeah, you can't. So you need to, it's something is, if you want to go for something that has that real, truthful connection, then you've got to really think about it and craft it well.
Yeah.
You know, so you can't... So, for instance, you're on the horse, you either have to have the volume rising, which is going to be nigh impossible, or you have to hold them back to have that intimate conversation. Once the conversation's thing, then they can go
then
run.
You can go...
You know, so then you can first run, but you've got to finish the conversation first.
Right.
But then you probably want to kill the person you're riding with. But gameplay is king.
Right.
But I love people who are tackling those, the challenges of the physical in performance. And in VR, it's massive, because if you're going to have a conversation head to head and you can actually move around and move away, how do you make that work?
Yeah.
And the only way I've seen it work elegantly is that, you know, either you're controlling the environment so that, you know, you can't break truth.
Yeah.
Or the truth is in your head somehow.
Yeah.
So, on an earpiece.
That comms thing.
But that works perfectly.
Yeah.
You know, that's the great thing about, games like Halo. They've got the helmets on.
Right.
Facial animation, dealt with. Proximity, dealt with. You know,
right.
it's fantastically simple but elegant and works.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, I love that kind of...
The creative problem solving thinking about that and how can we do it and justify it where it makes sense within the world. And you're dealing with different atmospheres and outer space and all of it. It's the greatest. It's the greatest stuff to be participating in and creating. I don't know, your enthusiasm and your commitment to making this space feel like a team is really, it's inspiring and great. And I really appreciate you.
Thank you very, very much for having me on your podcast.
Man.
This is so cool.
How can people find you on social media? Are you active on social media?
I'm on Twitter.
You're on Twitter. Great.
3571.
Uh-huh.
That's my nickname. That's my PIN number as well. But, you know, because I'm dyslexic and I forget numbers, you know, so, I've got to have it written somewhere. So it's, 3571 is SD, which is my nickname in numbers.
Awesome.
Also, I've just started a Facebook page, because I'm going to kick everybody out of my Facebook space, because I keep that for family and friends, and I've suddenly got hundreds and hundreds of actors on there. I don't link in with actors, simply because I keep that for business. And you know, there are processes. So on the web page for OM Los Angeles and London, it's omuk.com.
Uh-huh.
I can, And casting at omuk.com is where all actors come in. So we basically will database everybody. Anybody who will approach. We have an open door policy fundamentally for actors.
Really?
So you can queue up to come in. Because when we're not in production, we're casting. We're casting
constantly.
And we want to see people and test them in the booth. Because sometimes, you know, people come down, they're terrified first time.
Sure.
Then they go, oh, this is really fun. Then they want to come back again and do it again. And we give them that opportunity. We want to have, because it's all about relationship with the talent. Yeah. Because you guys are the ones that make us look fucking awesome when it all works. You know, we need each other.
Yeah.
And so it's, so we do have an open door policy in that when somebody applies, we basically go into the sausage machine. But we're doing that with the agents. We're starting to do that here, where we're saying to the agents, we're going to have open casting days. Can you send us your talent in 20-minute blocks? And we'll just work with those people, and then we'll you know, put them through the grading thing. We'll, you know, look at what they can do.
That's so marvelous. You know. That's so marvelous. In a town where you can come and feel like you're standing outside of doors that will never open unless you have some magical key.
Well, I was looking at some of the casting, you know, that I've gone through. Because what I do is kind of, you know, I blank out the actor. I don't care who the actor is at the casting stage. And, you know, and I've cast a couple of productions recently. Then I've looked at the actors and I went, these are really, really good actors, you know. And, you know, they've just gone straight into the D because they, you know. but that is the actual reality, because you're actually not focusing on the actor, you're focusing on the character. Yeah. And somebody is pushing the boundary high, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean everybody else is a failure. And you're saying, these people, I want to see them all in the booth. Not just the selected few who get through stage one of the, because one of the things I've heard recently, there's a couple of agents who have their own booth and voice director in the booth. I think a lot of the voice agents, actors agents are different. They're much more acting, and they just let the actors act, which is kind of really good.
Yeah.
So you're getting a subtlety and a nuanced performance in voice from acting agents, sometimes better than from the voice agents. Because the voice agents, there's a lot of agents who are fundamentally serving the advertising industry. There's the money there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there can be quite good money there.
Yeah.
You know, okay, games is a much bigger thing, but you've got a voice director in a booth at an agent who is dealing with advertising all the time. And so I've heard a few sessions where an actor's come in. They've left the mic on in the booth, so you can hear the booth mic, the booth director as well, which is really useful because the actor would have been dumped, you know, because the booth director, you know, the actor came, did a really natural performance. Oh, that was interesting. The booth director said, you know, started directing them and actually directed the life out of the, out of the actor's performance until they were overacting and selling cheese, and it was just like, and it was just, you know, the actors must trust their own instinct, you know, and especially, you know, the casting just throw themselves only at it, you know, and it's, but that's why we get people in, because you don't know what's happened or how a demo's been done.
Yeah.
Somebody may send a brilliant demo. Yeah, one of my most classic ones, which is hilarious. No, it wasn't. It was fucking just disgraceful. This guy sent one actor sent this voice demo in, which was amazing. It was this deep, gravelly, awesome voice. It was perfect for a role. And he came in, he talked like me. And I said, yeah, can we do this character? He said, this really heavy night. It was first thing in the morning, you know, when your voice goes down 4 octaves, you know.
Yeah.
And you went, I went, are you fucking stupid or what? You know, you
it's
can't.
Like photoshopping your headshot. It's like photoshopping your headshot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you want the zits and, you know.
Yeah, show me who's walking in the room when I hear your thing.
Yeah, yeah, be as ugly and as beautiful as you really are.
That's right.
Because natural is the most beautiful thing out there, you know, because what you're doing is populating worlds with natural things. You don't want perfect performances because the world ain't like that.
That's right.
Mo, it might be in Hollywood. But hey.
Shh. It's still pretty broken. The veneer is very, very pretty. But when the sun hits it just right, it's...
it's kind of fun making this town. It's kind of crazy town. I've really enjoyed doing this, Kiff. It's been a real pleasure.
Mark, I've had such a blast having you on. Thank you so much for being here. Yeah. Mark Estell, thank you so much for being here.
Way!
Yay, we did it!
This has been All Over VoiceOver with Kiff VH. For questions to be either answered on Twitter or on an upcoming cast, tweet to the show at AllOverVOKIF. Till next week, you get what you get and don't get upset. Claim victory and depart the field.